You're listening to the History Today podcast. In this episode, Matt Carr discusses one of the key turning points in the American Civil War.
General Sherman's march to the sea, his rampage through Georgia, which took place in 1864 during the American Civil War, is one of the most controversial episodes in US history. And it's the cover story of the November edition of History Today. And its author, Matt Carr, joins us. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
I wonder if, first of all, for those who are unaware or unfamiliar of Sherman's March to the Sea, if you could give us a quick summary of its course and perhaps explain some of its aims.
In September of 1864, Sherman's army, his 100,000 strong army, captured Atlanta, which was in Georgia, which was a major gain for the Union. Having captured Atlanta, Sherman was faced with various alternatives, really. He could either stay in Atlanta, garrison it, which would mean that he would have to kind of guard an attenuated supply line that went all the way back to Nashville, which would have used up a lot of his army. So basically, he had maintained an offensive momentum ever since the invasion of northern Georgia in May 1864. So he was in Atlanta. He could either hold on to the city that he'd captured, leave some of his army there and go north to help General Grant, the commander of the Union Army in Virginia, who was then locked into a stalemate with Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia around the capital of Richmond and Petersburg. Instead, Sherman decided to do none of these things. He decided he did not want to use up his army defending Atlanta and defending the supply line that he would have had to depend on to keep that garrison open. So he decided to go south into Georgia. And he had the explicit objective, as he took his army through Georgia, his aim was to basically teach Georgia in particular and the South in general a lesson that they would not forget, that he hoped would have a psychological impact, not just on the military effort in itself, but on the civilian population of Georgia. He thought that if he took his army through Georgia and he smashed up all the anything to do with war production in the state, that he would demonstrate to the South that they had lost the war, that they could not win, that there was no point in continuing. This message wasn't only intended to be transmitted towards the opposing army. It was explicitly aimed at the civilian population. And so there was some doubt in September and November, some arguments between Grant and Sherman. There was a series of telegrams went back and forth as they debated what should be done. And Sherman had to convince Grant that this was a viable strategy. Sherman, basically all the Union generals by that time had accepted that in order to win the Civil War, it was not simply a question of defeating Confederate armies in battle. They saw that the civilian population in various ways was facilitating the war effort, and they were shocked and surprised by how long the Confederacy lasted, even after they'd inflicted some serious defeats on the Confederate armies. So many Union generals saw civilians as part of the new way of waging war, that you didn't just fight armies. You also had to kind of punish civilians. You had to destroy war resources, which inevitably affected civilians as well. But Sherman, perhaps more than any other Union general, had an acute insight into the psychological dimensions of warfare. He called his campaign in Georgia not war, but statesmanship. That was his phrase for it. And he said that he wanted to penetrate to the inner recesses of the South and show them and demonstrate to them that everything their newspapers and politicians had told them, you know, about the that the Confederacy could survive through sheer willpower. He wanted to show, to demonstrate through the presence of his army, through the destruction that it could inflict, that this was not true. So in a way, it was a kind of early version of what the Pentagon now calls information warfare, without stretching that anomaly comparison too far. And that's basically what he did. He marched his army, he stripped his army down to two wings, marching about 20 to 40 miles apart, parallel to each other. He basically traveled with very few supplies, and he ordered his army to rely on the population, on the country they passed through to survive. And by marching in two wings, he was able to divide what Confederate forces were actually in Georgia. There weren't many, about 15,000, compared with Sherman's combined army of about 60,000. So on one level, there was never any possibility, really, that his army could be stopped, given its size. But Had the Confederacy understood his strategy better and had they been able to concentrate their forces, they could have slowed his armies down. And there was the possibility that they might have stopped it, for example, when it was trying to cross rivers. And if they bogged his army down, they might have undermined his whole strategy. Grant was aware of that, and so was Lincoln, which is one of the reasons why the two of them were both a bit reluctant to accept this strategy in the first place. But they did. The Confederates didn't do that. Sherman moved his armies with great skill and great speed through the state of Georgia, reaching Savannah, the coastal city of Savannah, in December, where he, just before actually capturing the city, he basically was his army was resupplied by the Union Navy. And he stayed there. We often think of the March to the Sea. It's often described as the March to the Sea, which it was. That's the part of the march that was most famous. But actually, if you look at Sherman's marches, they didn't end in Savannah. He gave himself little more than a month to refit his army, and then he marched north again to Virginia. His ultimate objective was Virginia, through the Carolinas, and he inflicted far more damage on the Carolinas, especially South Carolina, which is considered to be the kind of the heartbed, the seedbed of the rebellion. He inflicted huge damage on that state, more than in Georgia, in fact. And the march didn't really come to an end until April in 1865, in the capital of North Carolina, Raleigh. And by this time, it had become clear that the Confederacy was on the point of collapse, and it did collapse that same month. For various reasons. Sherman's army is one of the reasons. It wasn't the only reason. And so that is the strategy that Sherman put into practice in the last year of the Civil War.
And is there something about the nature of Civil War? I mean, we know this from the English Civil Wars and from other Civil Wars, that there's a level of vindictiveness that's there. Do you think that's true of Sherman's campaign, that there is something beyond merely the tactical and the strategic?
Yes and no, really. I mean, I think in terms of understanding why Sherman did what he did and why the Republican Party and President Lincoln approved of what he did, and also in terms of understanding why the Northern public approved of what Sherman did and why they actually celebrated that game, because on one level, it's kind of there have been many occasions in history in which armies have done this kind of thing. Scorched earth campaigns, punitive counterinsurgency campaigns directed to civilians that support guerrillas and so on. Sherman didn't invent these tactics. He didn't invent the psychological strategy himself. To understand why this developed within the Civil War itself is, I mean, at the beginning of the Civil War, the Union leadership had a relatively conciliatory policy towards the South. They were keen not to alienate everybody in the South. They thought that the rebellion was supported by a minority of the Southern population, and they believed that if they, for example, respected in the initial part of the war, if they respected the right of Southerners to have slaves in some states, they could keep some states on side, and they did do that. But they didn't do it enough. And as the war progressed, and as some Union armies began to penetrate into the South, and often were in the position of occupying large sections of Southern territory, they found themselves under attack by what they used to call bushwhackers, guerrillas, basically. And they began to realize that actually the rebellion had far more popular support than they'd thought, and that the guerrillas who were attacking them were surviving because of that support. So many Union generals began to change towards the policy that came under the name of hard war. They began to think that it was not enough just to win battles, that you could do things, for example, like you could carry out punitive operations in response for attacks on Union troops and so on. So lots of Union generals began to do this. Sherman probably took it further than anybody else, because he developed this punitive strategy into a kind of comprehensive view on how you could win wars between two relatively equal opponents. I know people don't think of the South and the North as relatively equal, given the kind of disparity in population and war production and so on. But each side had certain strategic advantages that meant that the war dragged on much longer than people had expected on either side, and that it became much nastier, much bloodier, and more vicious. So by the time Sherman actually carried out this campaign, this was after more than 3 years of war, in which had basically stunned, shocked the American public on both sides. Huge casualties, unprecedented casualties had been generated by some of these battles. And so really, there was an element of vindictiveness in it for sure, particularly in South Carolina. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Sherman himself writing to the Union commander Halleck in December, said that his whole army was burning, insatiable, with an insatiable desire to inflict vengeance on South Carolina. They regarded the South Carolina, they used to call it mockingly the chivalry, the aristocracy. There was absolutely no doubt that there was real vindictiveness went into that campaign in particular, much more than Georgia.
But the mythology of him as being the inventor of total war is an exaggeration, if not just simply wrong.
I think it is, and many historians think it is too. I mean, there's various reasons why that happened. I mean, one is that Southerners, there was this idea that Southerners had a certain image of themselves, of the way they fought wars and the way the Union fought wars. And the Southern self-image, military self-image, was chivalric warfare, that Southerners fought fairly, gallantly, in a Celtic fashion, as some of them used to put it, whereas the Union didn't. The Union was mechanical, anonymous, unheroic, brutal, ruthless, and merciless. And so Sherman, through that campaign, became the epitome of that form of Union, of the way that the Union was perceived to be fighting its wars. In some ways, it also suited the South, really, when they lost the war, to have this idea that they'd lost it because the other side didn't fight fairly, because the other side was more brutal, because they, because Robert E. Lee was more honorable in the way that he conducted his occupations and his invasions of the North than the Union were when they invaded the South. In some ways, this was a convenient way of understanding the war and remembering the war. It slotted neatly into the kind of lost cause romanticism about the war in the South, the idea that it had been a noble, brave cause, fought bravely, and had lost against an inhuman and brutal enemy. So in some ways, that image was developed in the years after the Civil War. And then, particularly beginning with the Southern historian John Bennett Waters' famous article in 1948, in which he basically said something to the effect that General Sherman was responsible for levels of torture, violence, and cruelty unprecedented in American history. This was around the time when the idea that Sherman had not only defeated the South through these exceptionally brutal, unprecedented methods, but he'd also created a kind of template of what has been called total war. And then you have historians like Little Hart. Little Hart actually doesn't really take the view. The British captain Little Hart, British military strategist, who had wrote a lot of books, influential books in the first half of the 20th century, he doesn't actually argue that Sherman invented total war, but he does argue that Sherman's emphasis on tactical flexibility and fluidity and mobility in warfare paved the way for things like the Blitzkrieg, tactics used by the German generals in World War II. So, personally, I think that the idea that Sherman invented total war is exaggerated. Some of the things he did, as I said before, armies had done for centuries. But it must be said also that Sherman did, he was probably a little bit ahead of his time, really, in the sense that he anticipated, he saw that warfare, the idea of the Napoleonic decisive battle, that basically two armies engaged in a decisive conflict, one of them killed more people than the other, and then it walked away winning, and then there'd be peace terms after that. He saw, through the experience of the Civil War, that this no longer was possible. This was no longer likely to be the future of warfare. It took the rest of the world a while to realize that, because in a way, despite what had happened in the Civil War, the lesson of World War I is that many armies didn't realize what Sherman had already seen.
And do his achievements suffice to call him a great commander?
There is dispute about that. I mean, Albert Castell, one of the key historians of South, who's basically done a famous book looking at Sherman's campaign to capture Atlanta, he argues that Sherman, like many of the other generals in the Civil War, was a flawed commander, was not necessarily the great all-seeing genius that his supporters, because that's another thing to remember, is that Sherman has many critics, of course, those who have accused him of being a monster, et cetera, et cetera. But he also has many supporters, Little Hart being the most obvious. Little Hart saw one of Little Hart's biography of Sherman, which he wrote in the 1920s. Little Hart portrayed Sherman as the kind of forgotten genius of the Civil War, even more than Grant, and argued that he and his tactics were the key reason why for the Southern defeat in the end of the war. So basically, I think you can say that Sherman was a great commander. You can say that he was a great commander in the skill with which he could move troops at great speed and in enemy terrain, and the way that he always maintained what Little Hart called the ability to sell the dummy. That was Little Hart's rugby phrase that he used to describe Sherman's tactics, i.e. that Sherman, by marching his army in two wings and moving at speed, would always make it difficult for his opponents to know where he was going to go. One of the reasons why he was able to move so quickly through Georgia and also in South Carolina was because the few Confederate forces that were there were never exactly sure where he was going to take his army. Sherman usually left his two wings at least two options, and sometimes more. The Confederates believed, for example, that he was going to attack Augusta in Georgia, where they had a very large gunpowder manufactory. And Sherman led them to believe that and then simply moved away from it. And he did this at various times. Another time when he was in South Carolina, he seemed to be moving toward Charleston. And then he simply moved away from Charleston. So these kind of tactics were used to great effect later by Patton, for example, during the after the Normandy landings, through the Third Army's march through the Third Army's Sherman-like rampage through France. In fact, Patton, according to Little Hart, said that before he carried out his campaigns in Brittany, he was going to carry out a super-style Sherman march. So, you know, Sherman has had an impact for sure, and there's no doubt that. In military terms, he was a great general, but he was—he made mistakes as well. And there are people, including Albert Castell, that argue that he should have taken his army directly into Virginia after capturing Atlanta, and that it would have been—he would—he might. There, I think Castell has also said that the Civil War might have ended sooner had he done that.
Well, Sherman is certainly a remarkable and fascinating character. And Matt Carr's article on Sherman's March to the Sea is the cover story of the November edition of History Today. And for those who want to explore more about Sherman and his campaigns, we can recommend Matt Carr's book, Sherman's Ghosts, Soldier Civilians in the American Way of War, which is published by the New Press. And thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
For talking to us. And thank you.
Thank you very much.